Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am going to be reading from the San Angelo Standard Times for the week of Sunday, June 19th, 2022. One thing before we begin, there were very few local news articles about San Angelo in this week's Standard Times. We'll read what we have, and then we'll supplement with state articles that were printed in the Standard Times, as well as local sports articles and a few features. Unidad Park in San Angelo set to reopen Friday evening, from staff reports published June 22nd. After an 8-month closure for renovations, Unidad Park will reopen to the public at 6:30 p.m. Friday, June 24th, according to a news release from the City of San Angelo. The park at 3245 Vista del Arroyo underwent a complete playground replacement, but still has many similar items that were enjoyed at the original playground, including a large playset for children ages 5 to 12, a smaller playset for ages 2 to 5, a large swing set, the original Carl's Fort, and a basketball toss funnel. New elements include a seesaw and merry-go-round with wheelchair access, two long track rides, a washer pitching area, and more. The project was funded by a grant from the San Angelo Area Health Foundation, 4B half-cent sales tax revenue dedicated to park improvements, and donations from private citizens, primarily received through the San Angelo Area Foundation's San Angelo Gives fundraising event. San Angelo Broadway Academy to perform high school musical by Angela Brooks, San Angelo Broadway Academy, published June 23rd. Disney's smash hit movie musical comes to life on stage at the Murphy Performance Hall this weekend. San Angelo Broadway Academy is proud to present Disney's high school musical, the modern-day Romeo and Juliet that first won its way into the hearts of audiences as a made-for-TV movie in 2006. The handsome basketball star Troy and beautiful brainy Gabriella battle the status quo expected by the set cliques in school, who are threatened by mixing groups when he happens upon Gabriella auditioning for the school musical and discovers that he can sing. While the drama club diva arranges to set up a clash of Troy's big game with Gabriella's science decathlon, friends on both sides emerge to save the day, to fuel a way to let the couple break free from expectations and shine on stage together. Stereotypes are relinquished and barriers between cliques are broken down as the characters' infectious enthusiasm and unity defy the odds over old expectations. Sing along with the familiar tunes and tap your feet with San Angelo Broadway Academy as they bring this optimistic coming-of-age musical to life. Tickets are $15 for adults and $12 for kids 12 and under. They can be purchased in advance at www.sanangelopac.org or at the door prior to the performance. Showtimes are Friday and Saturday at 7:30 p.m., and Saturday and Sunday at 2 p.m. El Dorado and San Angelo featured in Netflix series Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey about FLDS Church by Rosanna Frere, published June 21st. El Dorado and San Angelo are featured in a new Netflix true crime series about polygamous sect leader Warren Jeffs and the FLDS Church. It was trending at number 6 on the streaming site on Monday, June 20th. The series, Keep Sweet, Pray and Obey, explores the world of the fundamentalist Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which built a community of as many as 700 people on the Yearning for Zion Ranch in Schleicher County outside the small town of El Dorado. When the ranch was raided by law enforcement in April 2008, after a call alleging underage girls were being forced into marriage, it sparked the biggest child custody case in U.S. history. San Angelo found itself in the national spotlight, with FLDS families housed in the city. More than 400 children were involved. while trials were held at the Tom Green County Courthouse. The FLDS initially built a community in Short Creek, made up of the twin towns of Hilldale, Utah, and Colorado City, Arizona. But increased scrutiny from the media, law enforcement, and residents of the towns prompted them to purchase land outside El Dorado in 2003. Warren Jeffs had taken over as the prophet, or president, of the FLDS after his father, Rulon Jeffs, died in 2002. Warren Jeffs was placed on the FBI's 10 most wanted list in 2006 for his flight from the charges that he arranged illegal marriages between his adult male followers and underage girls in Utah. He also faced numerous charges in Arizona, including sexual conduct with minors. He was ultimately extradited in 2011 to San Angelo, where he was found guilty of sexual assault of a minor and aggravated sexual assault against a child for the girls he married at the ages of 12 and 15. Jeffs was sentenced to life in prison plus 20 years. In April 2014, the state of Texas took physical and legal possession of the YFC ranch. State news. Texas rejects more rigorous teacher certification exam, by Brian Lopez and Kate McGee, Texas Tribune, published June 19th. The State Board of Education on Friday unanimously rejected a new teacher certification exam that supporters dubbed the solution to prepare and retain new teachers, but critics worried it would create barriers for people of color to enter the profession. Many board members said the exam currently used by the state to certify teachers, known as the Pedagogy and Professional Responsibilities, is not an adequate test, but they did not feel switching to the new test, called the Educative Teacher Performance Assessment, addressed concerns about retaining teachers during a statewide teacher shortage and holding current educator prep programs accountable for how they prepare future students. "I feel there are some stones left unturned," said SBOE Chair Kevin Ellis, a Republican who represents Northeast Texas. "I would not consider a vote to reject a wooden stake through the heart of EdTPA. This is not the end of the road." Ellis proposed bringing stakeholders back to the table Monday to discuss possibly developing an additional exam or other potential solutions. The EdTPA exam was first approved in late April by the 11-member State Board of Educator Certification, which oversees the preparation, certification, and standards of conduct of public school educators, but it needed final approval from the State Board of Education to be implemented. The test, which was developed at Stanford University, requires teachers to submit answers to essay questions and provide a sample lesson plan, a 15-minute video of themselves teaching in the classroom, and a report on their students' progress. Proponents of the new exam say it will better support and retain new teachers because it can pinpoint exactly what a teacher lacks through the video recordings and written analyses provided. Those against the EdTPA say it creates a barrier for people of color entering the profession because it costs nearly $200 more than the Pedagogy and Professional Responsibilities exam currently used. The new exam has been scrapped in New York and Washington, two states where it had been required. "I don't believe the teacher candidates should be the conduit for cleaning up the system, nor should they bear the expense of that," said Audrey Young, a Republican representing Southeast Texas and part of the greater Houston area. This new licensing test would have replaced the PPR exam, a 100-question test that has been in use since 2002. Critics of the PPR teacher certification exam have called it a less-than-precise way of testing a teacher's new potential. All the questions on the test are multiple choice, making it easier to pass. Before Friday's vote, the board's Committee on School Initiatives, which is made up of five State Board of Education members, on Thursday recommended the full board reject the EdTPA exam. They cited that teachers and school administrators don't want it. It will negatively affect people of color. It's been adopted and then scrapped in other states. and there has been a lack of communication between stakeholders leading up to adoption. State Board of Education member Aisha Davis, a Democrat representing the Dallas-Fort Worth Metroplex, said on Thursday she doesn't think there was enough done to try and solve the issues people have with the PPR. "We haven't figured anything out to make anything better," she said. "We're just kind of getting rid of one problem to have to create to another." Ruben Cortez Jr., a Brownsville Democrat, on Thursday brought up a letter from 26 different teacher unions and education groups sent to the Texas State Board of Education members asking that the school reject the plan and instead mandate the certification board to increase training requirements of teacher preparation programs. But Texas Education Commissioner Mike Morath told board members Wednesday that EdTPA will help Texas's new teachers as they are more likely to leave the profession quicker and are more likely to serve low-income students and teachers of color. He called PPR trash. "Shame on us for 20 years ago rolling this thing out," he said. "We got to get rid of PPR." He also said it would take too long for Texas to come up with its own exam, and it would be easier to contract a proven exam like the EdTPA. The TEA is ready to set aside about $2 million to help prospective teachers pay for the more expensive exam. But on Friday, Davis accused the TEA of not providing board members with enough information to make an informed decision and wanted more information about why other states have scrapped EdTPA after requiring it. "I'm asking staff and the commissioner not to just lobby us with the product they want to push, but to give us unbiased data so we can make a good decision," she said. Closing the digital divide, Texas unveils its plan to expand access to broadband internet. The work from home, learn from home experience during the COVID-19 crisis underscored the need to improve access to high-speed internet in Texas. By John C. Moritz, Corpus Christi Caller Times, published June 16th. Austin. Saying high-speed internet has evolved from a luxury to a necessity, State Comptroller Glenn Hegar said this week he unveiled what he said will be a roadmap for expanding broadband connectivity to more than 1 million Texas households over the next few years. "Texans need reliable, high-speed connectivity for a wide range of potential applications, including public health, safety, education, and modern agriculture," said Hegar, the state's top financial officer, who was tasked with developing Texas's first plan to dramatically expand access to the broadband. Congress last year allocated Texas $500.5 million through the American Rescue Plan and $100 million more through the Infrastructure Act aimed at improving connectivity statewide. But Hegar said uncertainty remains over many of the federal rules and guidelines governing how exactly those funds must be spent. "Texas and other states will need flexibility from the federal government to best utilize the resources available to bridge the digital divide," the comptroller's office said in a news release. The plan will become more defined over time as federal agencies finalize program guidance and funding allocations. The state's broadband plan, outlined in a 134-page document, said the comptroller's broadband development office expects to have federally compliant grant programs in place by late summer so that the allocated money can begin flowing to Texas. After that, plans will be developed to allow local communities to apply for funding to build or upgrade internet infrastructure. The 2020 census found that 2.8 million Texas households lack broadband access, and hundreds of thousands of others have internet access with limited bandwidth. The disparities glared into the open as the COVID-19 pandemic took hold and shifted classrooms, work sites, and even medical visits to the virtual realm. "The COVID crisis really highlighted all of the challenges with broadband," said Jennifer Harris, who leads Connected Texas, part of a national nonprofit that seeks to close the digital divide coast to coast. "Whether it was areas that didn't have physical access, areas where it wasn't reliable, the affordability aspect, the access to device aspect, the digital skills aspect, I think all of that came to the forefront when COVID started. Harris, who is also vice chair of the governor's Broadband Development Council, called the plan a good start, but it will be several years before all of the pieces are in place, she said. The infusion of federal cash, even though all of the implementation details are not yet fully known, was key to getting the state's plan off the ground and vital to its success, Harris said. This was the single largest investment in broadband in our country that we will probably ever see, she said. So it couldn't be a more exciting time to finally, actually, truly, really do something about the digital divide. Status of broadband in Texas. The broadband plan shows that households in nearly every region of the state have access to high-speed internet. That access is lowest in East Texas, but access does not always equal connectivity. For instance, along the Gulf Coast, 92% of homes have access, but fewer than half of them actually have high-speed internet. The numbers are similar in the communities surrounding Austin. In Deep South Texas, fewer than 2 in 10 homes have high-speed connections, and in West Texas, it's 3 in 10. The best percentages are in the areas around Dallas-Fort Worth, San Antonio, the High Plains, and the Panhandle, where about 6 in 10 homes have high-speed connections. What drives the digital divide? According to the comptroller's findings, the counties along Texas's southern border and the upper east, south, and southeast regions are disproportionately low when it comes to broadband. These regions are predominantly rural or with very low suburban household density. Their populations are older or have very low incomes, and they have high numbers of households served by only one internet service provider, the report said. The best served regions are typically urban and suburban and have higher density populations, the report said. These regions are generally the least rural, the youngest, or the wealthiest by median income, the report states. From the front page of the San Angelo Standard Times, Wednesday, June 22nd. Texas official criticizes Uvalde police at hearing. Head of public safety says response was an abject failure. By Jim Vertuno and Jake Blyberg, Associated Press, Austin. Law enforcement authorities had enough officers on the scene of the Uvalde, Texas school massacre to have stopped the gunman 3 minutes after he entered the building, and they never checked a classroom door to see if it was locked, the Texas public safety chief testified Tuesday, pronouncing the police response an abject failure. Police officers with rifles instead stood and waited for over an hour before they finally stormed the classroom and killed the gunman, putting an end to the May 24th attack that left 19 children and 2 teachers dead. The classroom door, it turned out, could not be locked from the inside, yet there were no indications that officers tried to open the door while the gunman was inside. Colonel Steve McGraw, director of the Texas Department of Public Safety, testified. Instead, he said, police waited around for a key. I have great reasons to believe it was never secured, McCraw said of the door. How about trying the door and seeing if it's locked? McCraw testified at a state Senate hearing on the police handling of the tragedy. Delays in the law enforcement response have become the focus of federal, state, and local investigations. Obviously, not enough training was done in this situation, plain and simple, because terrible decisions were made by the on-site commander, McCraw said of Pete Arredondo, the Uvalde School District Police Chief. 8 minutes after the shooter entered the building, an officer reported that police had a hooligan crowbar that they could use to break down the classroom door, McCraw said. 19 minutes after the gunman entered, the first ballistic shield was brought into the building by police, the witness testified. McCraw told the Senate committee that Arredondo decided to put the lives of officers ahead of the lives of children. The public safety chief outlined for the community a series of missed opportunities, communication breakdowns, and other mistakes. Among them, Arredondo did not have a radio with him. Police and sheriff's radios did not work within the school. only the radios of Border Patrol agents on the scene worked inside the school, and even they did not work perfectly. Some diagrams of the school that police were using to coordinate their response were wrong. State police initially said the gunman entered the school through an exterior door that had been propped open by a teacher, but McCraw said that the teacher had closed the door and it could only be locked from the outside. "There's no way for her to know the door is locked," McCraw said. He walked straight through. Questions about the law enforcement response began days after the massacre. McCraw said 3 days after the shooting that Arredondo made the wrong decision when he chose not to storm the classroom for more than 70 minutes, even as trapped fourth graders inside two classrooms were desperately calling 911 for help, and anguished parents outside the school urged officers to go inside. Arredondo later said he didn't consider himself the person in charge and assumed someone else had taken control of the law enforcement response. Arredondo has declined repeated requests for comment to the Associated Press. As for the amount of time that elapsed before officers entered the classroom, McCraw said, "In an active shooter environment, that's intolerable. This set our profession back a decade. That's what it did," he said of the police response in Uvalde. The 18-year-old gunman used an AR-15-style semi-automatic rifle. In the days and weeks after the shooting, authorities gave conflicting and incorrect accounts of what happened, sometimes withdrawing statements hours after making them. But McCraw assured lawmakers, "Everything I've testified today is corroborated." McCraw said if he could make just one recommendation, it would be for more training. He also said a go bag should be put in every state patrol car in Texas, including a shield and door breaching tools. "I want every trooper to know how to breach and have the tools to do it," he said. From the San Angelo Standard-Times front page, published Monday, June 20th. Background checks still lack mental health records from three states. Advocates of Gun Rights, Gun Control, Allied in Closing Systems Gaps, by Nick Peslenstrater. Federal officials say the FBI's database of people prohibited from purchasing firearms only works if it has complete, accurate, and timely information. Mental health records are a key prong in the system, but three states, New Hampshire, Montana, and Wyoming, still refuse to submit them. As U.S. senators iron out gun reform initiatives, Republicans such as Senator John Cornyn of Texas repeatedly have pointed to legislation that stops people with criminal records or mental health challenges from obtaining firearms. Cornyn backed a 2018 bill that sought to shore up the FBI's National Instant Criminal Background Check system in the wake of a Texas church shooting that left 27 dead. The fatalities included the gunman, an Air Force airman, whose criminal records that would have barred him from purchasing guns had not been submitted to NICS. For years, agencies and states haven't complied with the law, failing to upload these critical records without consequence, Cornyn said while celebrating the Fix NICS solutions that pushed for faster and more accurate submissions. Just one record that's not properly reported could lead to tragedy. President Donald Trump signed that bill, which has pumped $615 million into states to close loopholes and shore up reporting into the FBI's system. States have made significant progress reporting into the database of 26 million records, including for 6.9 million people found by a judge to be mentally ill. Without state laws mandating participation, Montana and Wyoming have submitted 36 and 17 mental health records, respectively. New Hampshire has submitted 657. By comparison, Hawaii, with about the same population as New Hampshire, has submitted nearly 10,000 mental health records. Records from the three states' government-run mental health facilities show that many hundreds more people have been involuntarily committed, all of whom should have been submitted into NICS. History of the checks. The National Background Check System was established as part of the 1993 Brady Handgun Violence Prevention Act. Gun stores, pawn shops, and other licensed dealers nationwide must use it when someone wants to purchase a firearm. Prospective gun buyers must fill out a form from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives attesting to certain questions. Then their name is run through the FBI system. The FBI says more than 300 million checks have been made over time, leading to more than 2 million denials. Holes in the mental health reporting system gained attention in 2007 after a shooting at Virginia Tech left 32 dead. 2 years earlier, a court had found the student shooter an imminent danger to self or others after he was accused of stalking two female classmates, resulting in temporary detention that should have disqualified him from purchasing firearms. At the time, only about half of the states reported mental health records to NICS. By 2012, that number had shrunk to about 19 states that reported fewer than 100 records, and by 2014, it fell to 8. In 2016, it fell to 4 until Alaska increased its reporting. We know that a background check is only as good as the records it contains, so efforts to improve reporting of records into NICS are critical for public safety, said Kelly Drain, research director with Giffords Law Center, a gun violence prevention group. Research has shown that as states improve reporting of prohibiting mental health events into the background check system, we see a reduced risk of violent crime arrest for individuals that are prohibited. The Fix NICS law, written by Cornyn and Democratic Senator Chris Murphy, was dubbed as a baby step by gun control advocates, but won the support of both large gun lobbies, the National Rifle Association and the National Shooting Sports Foundation. The National Shooting Sports Foundation continues to lobby in New Hampshire, Montana, and Wyoming to tighten up the reporting. We are committed to ensuring the background check system reflects the most accurate data available, said Mark Oliva, the foundation's spokesman. Strange Bedfellows Back Effort. Efforts to broaden background checks should be universal, applying to private sales, have failed to pass at both state and federal levels. But gun rights lobbyists and gun safety groups both have coalesced around strengthening NICS. Opposition to doing so has created some strange bedfellows, said Susan Stearns, executive director of the New Hampshire branch of the National Alliance on Mental Illness. Stearns' group opposed a measure in 2017 to report mental illness to NICS, largely because it did not include a way to get off the list. The Alliance's position has always been, if they're a danger to themselves or others, they should be prevented from accessing lethal means, period, Stearns said. But you shouldn't lose constitutional rights for your lifetime. Stearns said people in a mental health crisis often recover, yet could be permanently prevented from participating in shooting sports and hunting. New Hampshire officials submit court records for anyone deemed incompetent to stand trial or not guilty by reason of insanity, but not those who are involuntarily committed to a health facility. The Alliance was lukewarm about a bill by former Democratic State Senator Margie McDonald in Montana, too, even though her bill included a pathway to be removed from the list after 5 years. McDonald tried in 2014 and again in 2019 to pass a bill requiring that the records be submitted. Ultimately, she said Republican opposition, fueled by hardline gun rights groups in the state, sunk her effort. It's disheartening, dismaying, and very dangerous, she added. McDonald hosted a Virginia Tech victim's father for a 2014 hearing in Helena, Montana, the mother of a woman killed in 2008 by a man who purchased a firearm just days after being involuntarily committed to a mental hospital, testified as well. He had lied on the ATF's form, answering no to whether he had ever been found to be mentally ill. Lying on the form can prompt fines and up to 10 years in prison. Data released to the Washington Post from the Department of Justice shows that cases tied to lying on the form are exceedingly rare, 243 in the fiscal year 2020, out of millions of checks. In Wyoming, former Representative Sarah Burlingame, Democrat Cheyenne, sponsored an effort in 2019 to mandate NICS mental health reporting that also failed. She said she faced top-notch misinformation testimony from groups like the Wyoming Gun Owners, backed by the Doar Brothers. Burlingame said Wyoming's ranking as the worst place for suicides per capita is reason enough to keep firearms away from people in crisis. This is tied to older white men, isolated, and having access to firearms, Burlingame said. If that doesn't inspire people to create a culture that preserves our cultural right to firearms and moral obligations, I don't know what will. It's common sense legislation that every other state has understood. From the front page of the San Angelo Standard-Times, Tuesday, June 21st. The long journey to a legal abortion. 15 women traveled from Texas to New Mexico for the procedure. By Madeline Meckelberg. Austin American Statesman, Dallas. The sky was still dark when the women began to gather at the First Unitarian Church of Dallas. They arrived one by one and were shepherded from the parking lot to a meeting area inside the church by volunteers from the congregation, each of whom had spent days preparing for this moment. "I'm here to help you," said one volunteer, offering her hand to a woman getting out of a car. "I've been in your shoes before." It was early, just after 5 a.m. The streets were deserted, save for the few cars headed toward the church. Whether it was the early hour or anticipation for the journey ahead, the women were quiet as they waited for the rest of their travel companions to arrive. Some nervously bounced their knees under a table, while others rested their heads on their arms, avoiding eye contact with the circling volunteers who offered snacks and cups of juice. When the group boarded a bus for the airport, there were 15 travelers, plus a mother accompanying her daughter. Besides the familiar pair, none of the women who gathered at the church knew any of the others. They were different ages and ethnicities, with varied personal backgrounds and professional histories. Some were college students, while others owned businesses or were newly unemployed. Several were parents, with young children and teenagers at home. Many of the women were from Dallas, but others hailed from farther reaches of the state, and at least one had traveled to the church from Oklahoma. But they all had at least one thing in common. Each was more than 6 weeks pregnant and could not have a legal abortion in Texas. "My biggest fear in life is not to have any options, and I feel like somebody who doesn't even know me took my options away from me, and it makes me furious," Amber, 26, said in an interview. When her doctor at the Southwestern Women's Surgical Center in Dallas told Amber she could not have the abortion she sought, she started to cry. "I was a couple days after what the law said I would have to be to get an abortion," she said. "That made me even more upset because, dang, a couple days?" She thought of her future and the life she was building for herself. She thought about the frequent doctor's appointments a pregnancy would entail and her lack of health insurance, after aging out of coverage under her parents' plan. She thought about the recent mass shooting at an elementary school in Uvalde, where 19 children were killed, and what dangers a future with a child might entail. Then, her doctor said there was one spot left in a travel program facilitated by a local church, a nonprofit, and abortion funds in Texas that would allow her to travel with a group of women from Dallas to New Mexico to have legal abortions free of charge. "I think we were all low-key, though we were going to get kidnapped," she said, speaking of her fellow travelers. "But what other choice did I have?" Women in Texas seeking abortions prepare for departure to New Mexico. The Reverend Daniel Cantor knew that fear would be a possibility. He had been organizing travel programs for women seeking abortions since December, offering free transportation and medical appointments to patients with incomes under the federal poverty line through a partnership with the New Mexico Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. In a meeting with volunteers 4 days before the departure of Amber's group, Cantor warned that the women participating in the program are often fearful when they arrive, worried about the law in Texas, and worried about the program itself. "No one owes us anything. not their story, not their thanks, not their acknowledgement, and not their smile, Cantor said, addressing the group of volunteers. In some cases, we're dealing with people who carry trauma and are primed not to trust us, so we need to present our most direct and gentle selves. He reiterated that the program is legal for now, as long as abortion remains legal in New Mexico and lawmakers in Texas don't attempt to restrict residents' ability to travel elsewhere for a procedure. Texas lawmakers have all but banned abortion, prohibiting the procedure at 6 weeks of pregnancy, before most people even know they are pregnant. In the past 9 months, women have been forced to carry unwanted pregnancies to term or cross state lines to have a legal abortion. Their options to go elsewhere narrowed last month when the Oklahoma legislature banned abortion with few exceptions in that state. If the U.S. Supreme Court decides to overturn Roe v. Wade and end nearly 50 years of federal constitutional protections for abortion, people with unwanted pregnancies will face similar dilemmas in broad swaths of the country. Justices are considering a challenge to a 10-week abortion ban in Mississippi that would allow the court's conservative majority to reverse protections for abortion and return the issue to the state legislatures. A ruling is expected by the end of this month. 26 states are poised to completely ban or severely restrict access to abortion if the court allows, including Texas, Oklahoma, Louisiana, Arkansas, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, South Carolina, Tennessee, Kentucky, and Florida in the South. Cantor said he plans to continue with his travel program for as long as he is able. He anticipates that demand will grow if Roe v. Wade is overturned. The program runs through a partnership with Cantor's church, the New Mexico Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice, the Southwestern's Women's Surgery Center in Dallas, and its sister clinic in Albuquerque, New Mexico, Southwestern Women's Options. The partnership was built on the foundation of a multi-faith chaplaincy program Cantor started with the Southwestern Women's Surgery Center in Dallas 6 years ago. Different religious leaders would spend time at the clinic, offering counseling to patients and a space to share their stories as they made decisions about their future. Religious organizations are often associated with the anti-abortion movement, but not all people of faith share that perspective, Cantor said. His own church has long-standing ties to the abortion rights movement dating back to 1973 when Roe v. Wade was argued. It's important for people to be reminded that not all their pastors, not all their preachers, not all their rabbis are against them, Cantor said in an interview. It's a disconnect to be sitting in a church like this and to have had an abortion and to hear your pastor telling you that you are somehow a sinner or are unredeemable. Our religion should be talking about how we love each other. That's the core of all religion, and pastors who perpetuate that shame are creating really kind of an emotional violence against the women in their congregations. When the abortion law, known as Senate Bill 8, went into effect in Texas, the chaplaincy program morphed into a travel program. People travel to the clinic in Dallas to determine how far along their pregnancy might be. If they are past 6 weeks of pregnancy, want to have an abortion, and meet certain income requirements, they're directed to Cantor's program. These are the poorest people in our communities, Cantor said. They just don't have the resources to navigate themselves to get an abortion in another state, and they don't have the resources to carry that prenate to birth. Arriving in Albuquerque, women seeking abortions find help. When the group landed in New Mexico, more volunteers were waiting in their cars outside the airport. About half of the women were taken directly to the clinic, where most were scheduled to receive surgical abortions. The others weren't due at the clinic until the afternoon, when they would receive the first dose of their medication abortion regimen. Volunteers drove the second group to the New Mexico Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choices headquarters in downtown Albuquerque, where rooms were set up in anticipation of their arrival. In the main gathering space, a table was piled high with snacks and breakfast foods, alongside a fully stocked fridge with sodas and other drinks. Another table held jigsaw puzzles, activity books, and coloring pages to help pass the time. There were black office chairs spread throughout the space, including in a dimly lit room toward the back of the office where a television was playing on low volume. As the women took their seats, they started to speak with one another, discussing their experiences with morning sickness, the plane ride, and details about their lives. I feel like we were all kind of quiet and just not feeling good, but we all started talking to each other and realizing that we're going through the same things, kind of, said Desiree, 22. It's like you're not alone. Desiree found out she was pregnant the same day she learned that she would be able to return to college in the fall, and she immediately started to panic. She pulled out her phone and called multiple clinics and crisis pregnancy centers in her area, trying to get an appointment for a sonogram. She found herself at a crisis pregnancy center, which promotes alternatives to abortion, where she was told she was too early in her pregnancy to have a sonogram. But a week later, she visited Southwestern Women's Surgery Center in Dallas and learned that this was not the case. In fact, a sonogram revealed that she was too far along to have an abortion in Texas. I probably could have gotten a sonogram done earlier and I could have avoided all of this, she said. I was really hard on myself because I was like, I waited too late. I should have been more on it and doing better research on the clinics I was going to. She grew up the oldest of six children, and their parents were in and out of their lives, leaving many childcare duties to Desiree and her brother. The experience gave her a deep appreciation for the responsibility of parenthood and made her question whether she wanted children of her own. When she learned about the travel program, Desiree said she signed up immediately, even though she was apprehensive about traveling with a group of strangers to have an abortion. I know my other options were going to be harder, she said. Kiara, 25, felt the same way. She already had three children at home, a 5-year-old, a 4-year-old, and a 6-month-old. And the prospect of trying to coordinate her own travel to another state to have an abortion was daunting. But the prospect of having a fourth child felt impossible. I didn't want to have two children under the age of one again, she said. I love my children, but I just don't want to have to deal with having the worry of feeding another mouth with the shortage of Similac and having to deal with that kind of stress. When Kiara found out she was pregnant with her second child, months after giving birth to her first, she was homeless and experiencing domestic violence in her relationship. She went to a clinic in the hopes of having an abortion, but she couldn't pull herself enough money and decided to continue her pregnancy. This time she has a roof over her head and a small support network of close relations who help care for her young children, but she still did not want to have another child. I probably would have been one of those girls who probably tried to self-abort, just because I know at this very state that I am not prepared to have a fourth one, Kiara said. She had heard stories about friends of friends who tried to end their pregnancies by drinking a cap of bleach or taking a large dose of vitamin C. She also had seen message boards online of people talking about different strategies for ending pregnancies that are not approved by the Food and Drug Administration. Obviously, if it wasn't something serious, a woman wouldn't be risking her life to take something away that she knows at the moment she either can't take care of, can't provide for, or she's just not ready to be a mother yet, she said. It's your life. If you're not ready, you're not ready, and no one should force you to be ready. Road to Recovery. As the second group of women made the trip from the coalition's office to the clinic, the first group started to return from the morning appointments. Some of the women were nauseated and went to lie down in a private room down the hall from the main gathering space. The lights were turned out and instrumental meditation music played as they found places to relax on yoga mats, cushions, and an exercise ball. Next door, a volunteer offered massage treatments to each returning patient. She taped up a large poster board in the hallway, encouraging women to write their names and reserve a time slot. In another room, three women gathered around a table to eat lunch after returning from medication abortion appointments at the clinic earlier in the day. Amber, Desiree, and DA, 22, nibbled on sandwiches and swapped stories about their lives. DA, a college student, said she was worried about managing her recovery when she returned home. She had kept her pregnancy and subsequent abortion a secret from her friends, and she struggled to find support from her friends. I told my best friend yesterday, and she acted like it was fine. And then later on, I asked if they could stay with me over the weekend, and she told me that she's not comfortable because it's a life and I'm hiding it from my parents, she said. Are you saying that's more important to you than being with me while I'm going through this? Even though I felt confident about my decision because I know this is what I needed to do, I began to feel so emotionally weary. Amber agreed and said her mental health has suffered during her pregnancy. She started going to therapy twice a week to help make sense of her feelings about ending her pregnancy and reminders of the first time she chose to have an abortion. Her first abortion came from before the Texas law banning most abortions. She was a victim of sexual assault and became pregnant after the encounter. After some consideration, she decided that she wanted to have an abortion. Once you get done and once you get through the pain, it still lingers, Amber said. After the first, I would always think, wow, I would have been a mom right now. My kid would have been this many months, and me and my boyfriend would be doing this. It's still hard to think about. Even though it was before the state's restrictive law was adopted, she described the stigma she sees around abortion, regardless of the circumstances. There were people outside the abortion clinic, and they were yelling at me, telling me I was murdering my baby and how I'm a bad person, Amber said. I just thought, if you knew my story, you would know that a bad person did this to me. I didn't ask for this. It wasn't because my skirt was too short. It wasn't because I wanted to be pregnant by somebody other than the person I was with for multiple years. Like somebody saw something they wanted from me, and they took it without without my permission. The women were quiet as Amber wiped tears from her eyes, offering somber smiles and nods of affirmation as she discussed her experience. I'm just thinking back to all those moments where I sat by myself on the bathroom floor, crying and questioning why this is happening, DA said. I felt like I was just getting my life together, and then everything crashed. When you come here, it's like I'm not the only person going through this. There's so many people going through their own hardships, and we all have to help each other. It's not like we all started talking to each other immediately, but as we went through the day, we started opening up to each other and realizing that we were going through similar situations and having similar struggles in a process where you're made to feel so alone. Soon the women would climb once more into the waiting cars of volunteers and make their way back to the airport, closing out a long, physically and emotionally draining day. After their flight, the sky was dark when the women boarded a bus bound for the First Unitarian Church of Dallas. They would arrive back at the church roughly 16 hours after their initial arrival, but this time they knew what to expect. They were all exhausted and eager to return home. Some had exchanged contact information in the hopes of staying in touch. Cantor invited them all back to the church for a future service. When I found out this was through a church, I was very surprised, Amber said. I was scared that it was going to be really dim and bleak and scary, and it was the complete opposite. I was shocked to see a congregation that treated choice the way I did. I'm going to come back. And now sports. Former Abilene Cooper basketball coach Arsenio Getter excited about San Angelo Central job. By Charles Bryce, published June 21st. Coming back to San Angelo Central High was too good of an opportunity to pass up for new Lady Cats head basketball coach Arsenio Getter. 5 years after he was an assistant for the Central Boys under former head coach Dustin Fott in the 2016-17 season, Getter was recently hired to replace Jordan Sarton as the Lady Cats coach. Getter spent the last 3 years as the head coach at Abilene Cooper. The Lady Coopers went 47-47 during his tenure. In Sarton's only season, Central finished 18-12 overall and 7-1 in District 2-6A to earn the number 3 playoff seed. The Lady Cats lost in by district. Getter has coached against the Lady Cats the last couple of years, and he knows firsthand about their tradition. They've always had some really good athletes, Getter said of the Lady Cats. They have a really good chance to be successful, so we're excited about getting there and playing some good basketball and winning some games. Getter's best season at Cooper was his first year when the Lady Cougars won a share of the District 4-5A title and advanced to the playoffs in the 2019-20 season. Last season, Cooper finished 13-19 overall and 0-10 in district. We were 13-9 before district started, and every team in our district had a girl who was 6'2 or taller, and our biggest girl was 5'10, Getter said. We lost the rebounding battle quite often. And that's one thing that we like to stress is we're going to try to win the rebuilding battle, because I know if you win the rebounding battle, you're going to put yourself in a pretty good spot to be successful. The Lady Cats' new leader talked about his style of coaching. We like to run, so we're going to get out and run, and we're going to try to score in transition and play some really good defense in transition, Getter said. We'll play a lot of man defense and pressure the ball. We like to pressure the ball and make sure that the offense puts the ball on the court, and that way we can have a chance to really make them sweat and worry. Getter wants his teams to be fast on defense and slow and methodical on offense. We're looking for layups and good shots, and we're 100% defense first, but our defense turns into offense, he said. Getter is a graduate of Muleshoe High School and West Texas A&M University, where he spent some time on the basketball team as a walk-on. His other coaching stops were in Brennan, Brownfield, Borger, McCamey, and Hondo, where he got his first head coaching job. You only have to spend a few minutes with him to get a feel for what he's like to work with and be around. One of the things that I think is one of my specialties is my personality, Getter said. I kind of get along with everybody. I hold my ground, but I like to make sure that I find out what appeases most people. I'm just a problem solver. I'm real vocal and I communicate well, so I think that's going to go along well with our program, with our girls and the community. I think they're excited about the way I talk to people, and I'm able to be out and about in the community and hopefully get some people excited about our girls' basketball program. New El Dorado coach Chad Tuttle couldn't turn down opportunity to coach Eagles, by Amy McDaniel, published June 17th. It will be his third house in two seasons, but Chad Tuttle couldn't pass up a shot to lead the El Dorado Eagles football program. Tuttle, who has been the offensive coordinator at three West Texas stops, including just one season at Cahoma, is on the move again after he accepted the position as head football coach and athletic director at El Dorado. Tuttle, who led offenses at Ira Ann and Winters in addition to Cahoma, replaces John Long. Long, a former San Angelo Central assistant who guided the Eagles to the third round of the playoffs for the first time in 71 years, left El Dorado after two seasons to take a position as strength and coordinating coordinator at Caddo Mills under Cody Crane, a former Central assistant and brother of current Central coach Kevin Crane. It's pretty tough to leave Cahoma. We've only been here a year, said Tuttle, whose wife Kendra is an elementary school teacher. There are great kids here, and we have a lot of family here, but it was just a good opportunity in El Dorado, and I couldn't pass it up. Unable to find a place to live in Cahoma before last year's football season, the couple and their two children lived in Big Spring, 10 miles away. Last Sunday, as the Tuttles were unpacking in a new place in Cahoma, the coach got the call from El Dorado. She's a great wife and a rock star as a teacher, said Tuttle of his wife, who will also work for Schleicher County ISD. Tuttle, an Angelo State graduate, was first hired by Jason Herring at Sonora in 2006. Tuttle also worked with Sean Lehman, David Sine, and Creighton Phillips at Sonora before moving on to Ira Ann, where he worked for Mark Kirchhoff and then Corby Maurer. He was promoted to offensive coordinator his final year coaching for the Braves. From there, Tuttle worked two seasons as offensive coordinator for Winters head coach Matt McCarty. The son of longtime coach Gene Tuttle, who earned all West Texas Coach of the Year honors during his stint at Bront in the late 1980s, Chad Tuttle has soaked up a lot of coaching knowledge in his 16-year career. "I've been very blessed," Tuttle said. "Even moving around to a couple of schools, I've continued to work with some good guys, and it's been a blessing for our family." Tuttle counts the chance to coach at El Dorado as another blessing. "I've been around El Dorado most of my career," he said. "The kids have always been hardworking and very tough kids. You can do anything with those types of kids. They're yes sir and no sir kids, both the boys and the girls, and very tough kids who win games and are loyal to the people that love them." While the Eagles have played for two head coaches in the past 5 years, both left the program better than they found it. Michael Johnson, also a former Central assistant, helped El Dorado win a playoff game for the first time in 19 years, before Long took over in 2020 and posted a 16-6 record in two seasons with three playoff wins. Cristobal ISD approves edition of Volleyball by Amy McDaniel, published June 16th. Cristobal High School is adding volleyball to its slate of girls' athletic programs. The decision was approved Wednesday at a regular meeting of the Cristobal ISD Board of Trustees, and the school already has two coaches in place and plans for a summer camp. Cristobal Athletic Director Casey Otho said he's excited that girls in Cristobal have a chance to compete in a full complement of sports like the Cristobal boys. While Cristobal has competed in cross country in the fall, the first team sport for competition during the year is basketball in winter. If a girl chooses not to play basketball, they must wait until spring for softball competition. "Our boys play every sport together, and now this group of 6th, 7th, and 8th grade girls have all played basketball and volleyball at the Y together, and it's just a different dynamic," Otho said. "It gives them a chance to compete in the fall." Otho, who will start his 10th year at Cristobal, said Jen Tilson and Haley Marth will lead the volleyball startup. Marth started Cristobal's softball program, while Tilson came to Cristobal several years ago as an assistant basketball and track coach and was approached by Otho with the opportunity to get back into coaching. Cristobal is hosting a volleyball camp for students in 1st through 9th grades, according to CristobalISD.org. The camp is set for July 25th through 27th, at the school's newly built multi-purpose gym and will cost $50 per camper. Otho, who has a daughter who will be in 7th grade, reiterated his comments on his promotion to athletic director in July 2021 and hoping to bring more cohesion to the entire athletic program. He said there were about 40 girls involved in basketball last season, while there are 71 athletes in 6th through freshman classes who say they are interested in volleyball. "It gives them more of a chance to compete in the fall," Otho said. Cristobal will compete at the junior high level and have two junior varsity teams that will play an independent schedule until they can be placed into a district at the next biennial UIL realignment, Otho said. With the multi-purpose gym, Cristobal will be able to immediately host competition. Class 2A Cristobal is the second San Angelo area school in the last calendar year to add the sport. Class 3A Ballinger opted to add volleyball in June 2021. Ballinger is aligned into a district for the 2023 and 2024 school years, but is still at least a year away from competing at the varsity level. While Cristobal will join other longtime West Texas 1A and 2A programs, such as Wink, Miles, Water Valley, Bront, and Colorado City, there are also several other 2A programs in Region 1 with shorter histories. Forsan, Sterling City, Junction, and Coleman were in Class 2A last year, while Sonora and Reagan County were recently aligned into 2A, down from 3A. Any of those teams could be potential district opponents for Cristobal in 2 years. And now here's our weekly column from Allison Watkins. Tips for Landscaping in the Shade in West Texas. Published June 17th. The summer heat is scorching, and those with large shade trees in the landscape are surely enjoying the cover that the canopies provide, reducing electricity bills and helping to keep the home and yard cooler. But landscaping in the shade can be challenging. Turf grass does not grow well in shade, and there are many popular landscape plants that need full sun to thrive and bloom. Some of the particularly difficult spots include the north side of the home, the center of large live oak trees, or narrow sides of the yard between a tall fence and the home. In these cases, it's best to choose plants that are particularly well adapted to shady conditions and avoid turf grass. Live oaks have thick canopies, and often the lawn thins out or goes bare around the trunk of large live oaks, even shade-tolerant St. Augustine grass. Consider whether it could be feasible to create a bed around the trunk with the ground cover like Asian jasmine or mondo grass. It's important to use drought-tolerant, well-adapted plants in the landscape to reduce the need for water, fertilizer, and pesticides, and to have healthy, thriving plants with less effort. But as wonderful as shade is, most native, well-adapted plants to West Texas do best in full sun. Many of the plants that love shade will need acidic soil and lots of moisture to grow well. So finding tough plants that don't need a lot of water can be especially hard for shady yards in West Texas. Small ornamental trees and large shrubs that can handle part shade include redbud, Mexican buckeye, rough leaf dogwood, American beautyberry, althea, oak leaf hydrangea, glossy abelia, nandina, possum hall holly, and yaupon holly. Mexican buckeye blooms attractive pink flowers in the spring, while yaupon and possum hall holly have bright berries in the fall. Rough leaf dogwood and oak leaf hydrangea prefer the eastern half of the state, but can be grown here in well-prepared deep soil. Flowering perennials that will grow and bloom in the shade include Texas gold columbine, lyre leaf sage, autumn sage, mealy cup sage, and Turk's cap. And a couple of interesting foliage plants to try would be leopard plant and inland sea oats. To have the best success with landscaping in the challenging West Texas climate, prepare soil with compost before planting. Utilize drip irrigation and finish off with a 3 to 4 inch deep layer of wood mulch. Water anything newly planted frequently at first, but gradually train plants to go longer between thorough waterings to help train deeper roots that can survive heat and drought. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.